Hi, everybody, and welcome to Context Countdown. I'm Andrew Krupko, and I'll be going over 5 recent news stories that need to be placed in context. Some of them are misleading, while others are spot on, but either way, there's a context behind them, and I'm here to tell you what's really going on. Let's take a look at our top 5 countdown for the week. At number 5, we have the post-election coalition forming process in Latvia, which might see the country's most popular and, incidentally, Russian-friendly party lead the NATO member state. The Harmony Party won nearly 20% of the vote, followed by two populist parties who received a combined total of around 27%, meaning that the three forces could potentially form the next government. Harmony topped the polls before, but was denied the chance to lead the state out of xenophobic fears that the Russian-friendly party that represents the roughly one-quarter of Russian-speaking people in Latvia would act as a so-called Trojan horse of the Kremlin. This is ridiculous, because the country's permanent military, intelligence, and diplomatic bureaucracies, or deep state, would ensure that they don't implement any policies that would put Latvia's EU or NATO memberships at risk. Harmony stands first and foremost for the rights of Latvia's so-called non-citizens, who are non-Latvian-speaking people such as the Russian minority that suddenly wound up in this by-then foreign country after the Soviet dissolution, but couldn't become legal citizens despite living there for generations because they can't pass its strict language fluency test, seeing as how Latvian is universally recognized as one of the world's toughest languages to master. This deplorable state of affairs is one of the EU's biggest shames. And that's why this population and others rallied behind Harmony during last Sunday's elections. As for the two populist parties' impressive showing, that's largely due to the incumbent Liberal government's inefficiency, which also taps into widespread anger at the local level, just like Harmony's message does in its own way too. Naturally, given their commonalities, these three groups would probably form a much more stable governing coalition than any other possible arrangement, but the state might try to once again prevent this from happening because of how politically incorrect it would be to have a Russian-friendly party leading the government, even though it's only in favor of Russian-speaking non-citizens' rights and isn't a so-called pawn of President Putin. Going against the people's will by preventing Harmony from forming the government would be yet another hypocritical, self-inflicted wound to the EU's so-called democratic values, just as going along with this scenario but later sabotaging its policy-making potential by co-opting one of the populist parties to the side of the establishment would do the same. There's also the chance that behind-the-scenes compromises might be made whereby Harmony is allowed to govern as long as it immediately commits to an increase in NATO support so as to counteract the fake news narrative that the group is functioning as Russia's proxy. If that needs to happen in order to give the Russian-speaking non-citizens of Latvia a shot at dismantling the state's apartheid regime, then it might be a pragmatic compromise worth considering. The next one up is the upcoming summit between Russian President Vladimir Putin and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which will be their first meeting since last month's tragedy. The Israeli premier said that he spoke to President Putin on Sunday, which just so happened to be the Russian leader's birthday, and announced that they'll meet face-to-face sometime soon. There'll surely be a lot for them to talk about when they do, though, since Moscow has already gone through with its promised shipment of S-300s to Syria that Tel Aviv warned earlier this year might prompt it to destroy these defensive anti-air systems if Damascus uses them against its aircraft whenever they engage on bombing missions in the Arab Republic. The Russian Defense Ministry acknowledged that Israel's previous claim of carrying out over 200 bombings there in the past 18 months alone was true, but remarked shortly after last month's tragedy that they only informed Moscow in advance through the so-called deconfliction mechanism created just prior to Russia's 2015 anti-terrorist intervention in only around 10% of these total attacks. That will probably change now that the S-300s are in Syria, though that development in and of itself doesn't exactly mean what many people might think that it does either. The Russian military is still in possession of these systems and training their Syrian counterparts over a 3-month period in how to use them, after which it's almost been deliberately left ambiguous whether they'll be fully transferred to their host control or not. Russian spokespeople have said on numerous occasions that the S-300s are being shipped to Syria strictly to ensure the safety of their troops there, which leaves open the conceivable possibility that a so-called compromise might be reached between Russia and Israel to have Moscow retain control over these systems instead of giving Damascus full and independent control over them, which might further an incipient rapprochement between Russia and Israel and prevent the regional situation from becoming more unpredictable. Israel has made it clear that it will not stop attacking the IRGC and Hezbollah positions in Syria that it believes pose a threat to its national security, while Syria will probably defend itself with the S-300s if it does, potentially sparking a larger war despite this being its sovereign right. Understanding this dynamic, reports have recently surfaced that Russia is trying to mediate between Iran and Israel in Syria in order to prevent Tel Aviv from partaking in any more strikes in the first place, which might be why President Putin said last week that Moscow is, quote, pursuing a goal that there would be no foreign forces of third states in Syria at all, end quote, after the end of the war. Ideally, Russia will try to facilitate a so-called gentleman's agreement between the two regional adversaries, which could be part of what President Putin discusses with Netanyahu during their forthcoming summit. Third on our countdown, we have right-wing Brazilian presidential candidate Jair Bolsonaro's strong showing in last weekend's elections, which might see the tropical Trump win the second round. The firebrand populist narrowly missed winning the first round outright after clinching a surprising 46% of the vote, and is now on track to possibly trounce his leftist competitor Fernando Haddad during this second round on the 28th of October. Most people are already aware of Bolsonaro's ultra-controversial comments on social issues, so there is no need to reiterate them in the interim period before the final vote. But what's important to focus on during this time is how the U.S.-backed hybrid war on Brazil shaped the electoral environment in his favor. Operation Car Wash, the far-reaching anti-corruption inquisition that brought down former President Dilma Rousseff's government and led to the imprisonment of former President Lula, was facilitated by the NSA and succeeded in exposing the deeply entrenched corruption of the governing leftist elites and some of the right-wing opposition. This increased the people's apathy in their country's political process more than anything else ever could have, and it also had the effect of making Bolsonaro, who at the time was a fringe politician that barely passed any legislation at all despite his decades in office, a national hero of sorts because he was proven to have been one of the country's only uncorrupt lawmakers. This newfound attention allowed him to amplify his socioeconomic messages of arming the populace and privatizing the economy to a national audience, which was remarkably receptive to what had previously been considered to be these extreme measures. That only goes to show, however, just how far the so-called Overton window has shifted in normalizing previously radical positions following the success of the U.S.-backed hybrid war on Brazil, which specifically targeted the legitimacy of the ruling socialist at the time. The country has also been in the throes of an ever-worsening crime wave that the previous administration hadn't done much to stop, which is why Bolsonaro's gun rights and anti-crime messages are so wildly popular among many, just like Philippine President Duterte's crackdown on drug gangs has earlier proven to be among his own countrymen. The situation for many in Brazil has devolved to the point where they're mostly just interested in bread, shelter, and security. And while the socialists delivered on the first two of the people's needs, it might ultimately be the last mentioned one which explains Bolsonaro's surging popularity even more than his uncorrupt reputation. Be that as it may, the pollsters were surprised by his showing last Sunday because it seems that many of his supporters didn't feel comfortable openly backing him before the vote. Just like with Trump in 2016, they might have felt that others would denigrate them for being racist, fascist, or white supremacist, and therefore felt it better to self-censor their views until they could privately express them en masse during the election. Having explained all of that, it would be disingenuous to attribute Bolsonaro's rise solely to the US-backed hybrid war on Brazil while overlooking the country's pre-existing polarization and the policy failings of the socialists. It's more the result of a combination of the two, though the effect that the hybrid war had on shaping the electoral environment beforehand in Bolsonaro's favor, more so than any other presidential candidates, is important to dwell upon because it suggests that he may have been identified by the U.S. far in advance as their preferred candidate for leading Brazil. Our runner-up is the dispute between Germany and Italy over whether the regional Bavarian government will indeed ship some migrants back to Italy, which Rome says it's totally against. Berlin denied that such a plan was in the pipeline after such a scheme was reported in the media over the weekend and immediately prompted Italian Interior Minister Matteo Salvini to declare that he will close his country's airports to any planes shipping migrants into Italy. The two countries had supposedly been in talks about the issue of Germany finally implementing the Dublin Agreement's provisions that would allow it to return asylum seekers to the first EU country that they transited through, which would, in many cases, be Italy. This could, in theory, mitigate some of the growing grassroots opposition to Merkel's governing coalition, but it would inevitably burden the Euro-realist government in Italy with more migrants than the public might approve of. That's why there were earlier reports that Rome wanted to revise this agreement's provisions to allow for it to send some of these migrants elsewhere in the EU, which brings the whole issue full circle because many of the bloc's Central and Eastern European members are against this. The ideal solution would be if non-member countries in North Africa and the Balkans agreed to host so-called disembarkation centers, according to a proposal that was made earlier this year. But it proved so unpopular among their people and governments that it might be politically impossible for any of them to ever implement, even if the price is right. As such, the fate of many migrants might ultimately be that they continue being passed around as proverbial hot potatoes because nobody really wants them, yet they're unwilling, at this point, to send them back to their homelands. Merkel is therefore in a dilemma because she needs to do something about the heavily politicized migrant issue in her country that she's responsible for, yet she also has to balance her domestic political imperatives with her broader ones as the bloc's de facto leader, and not pushing the Central and Eastern European countries, and especially Poland and Hungary, further away from Germany's influence by trying to force them to accept these migrants as part of a reformed Dublin Agreement. It's unclear at this point in time how she'll resolve this conundrum, but it's inarguable that it's an avoidable one entirely of her own making. At our top spot, we've got the far-reaching implications for the U.S. if the incoming Mexican government goes through with the current defense minister's suggestion to legalize opium for medicinal use. This so-called solution has long been discussed and is seen by some as a pragmatic approach for lessening the heavy carnage caused by the country's drug war over the past decade, which has killed more than 200,000 people since it first began in 2006. The concept is simple enough and is that the country's opium farmers, which have made Mexico the world's third largest supplier of this drug, would sell their harvest to government-approved entities for use in scientific studies and medicine, instead of giving them to the cartels, though this would require that the state provide adequate protection to both the farmers and their crops. This is a lot easier said than done because the security services are thought to be deeply infiltrated by the cartels, and many citizens live in fear of what would happen if these forces found out that they were cooperating with the government. Mexico would therefore probably have to go through with the president-elect Andrés Manuel López Obrador, popularly known by his initials as AMLO, previously proposed in calling for a ceasefire with the cartels, and even bestowing amnesty on non-violent members of these gangs in order to restore national stability. For as risky of a policy as it may be, it's not impossible for it to succeed to the benefit of most Mexicans as a whole, though that doesn't mean that it would also be in the U.S.'s national interest to see this plan unfold. The country has been so ravaged by the collateral damage caused by the rampant use of hard drugs within a society, which includes crime waves and overdoses, that the legalization of opium for medicinal use in Mexico might make its drug crisis many orders of magnitude worse if there aren't proper border security measures in place beforehand. Unless Mexico is successful in purging its security forces and the state in general of the cartel's pernicious influence, which is highly unlikely, then the U.S., a southern neighbor, will practically transform into one of America's greatest hybrid war threats overnight if this legalization proposal is ever implemented. The expected large-scale export of opium or its manufactured heroin product from Mexico into the U.S. would ravage local communities even more than they already are, and could contribute to the drug being even more easily and cheaply available than ever before, thus leading to more addictions that people will have to battle for the rest of their lives, to say nothing of the consequent crime wave that might follow. There's simply no way that legalizing opium for any purposes in Mexico is good for the U.S.'s so-called soft security if its southern neighbor remains totally corrupt and strict border security isn't in place. It can therefore be expected that the U.S. will either pressure Mexico to keep opium cultivation illegal, or will try to find a way to shield itself from the catastrophic consequences if this happens. So folks, there you have it. This wraps up this week's edition of Context Countdown. And as I always do each and every week, I want to warmly thank you guys for tuning into my program. And I hope you guys will tune in again next week. Thank you. Bye.